what is two stories tall, can lift the weight of 40 cars over its head, and weighs more than a 737? The Letourneau L2350, the largest front-end loader in the world. The Letourneau Company of Longview, Texas builds these giants to load coal, gold and copper ore, and other minerals into equally giant trucks. Near the plant, there's a test site where the machine is put through its paces.
The need for the 2350 was born from the need to load bigger trucks. The dump trucks are getting bigger and bigger. If you can move more dirt with less people, that's the name of the game.
Massive 16-inch hydraulic cylinders lift the big bucket.
We could dig an Olympic-sized swimming pool in just a few scoops. I know we just have to be the envy of all the kids that are playing in their sandbox. We just happen to have the biggest sandbox and the biggest toys to play with.
Indeed they do. Thanks to R.G. Letourneau. I mentioned him about a month ago. I told you I'd be talking about him. By the way, that's the main biography. Jeff Cade told me about this book, and I read it and absolutely loved it a couple years ago. Mover of Men and Mountains. I highly recommend you check that out. So if you've been with us for a while, you know I do an annual biography. If not, let me explain why I do this. I do it on or around Reformation Sunday, and I do that because, of course, the Reformation, the Protestant Reformation, at its core, was a rediscovery of the gospel. When Martin Luther saw from Romans that there was a righteousness from God apart from the law, by which the law and the prophets testify, a righteousness that comes by faith. When he rediscovered the gospel, it has literally turned the world upside down. Then what it did was put the gospel into the hands of everyday people by translating it into German, then all other languages, and that work is still going on today, isn't it? So it's made the gospel accessible, and then it makes the gospel a part, hopefully, kind of as John is praying there as well, into our daily lives. So that's why I share an annual biography, and one of, just give you an idea of what I've covered in the last years, and up until this point, all of those folks, men and women, have either been, for the most part, missionaries, pastors, theologians, hymn writers, whose vocation, whose livelihood has mostly been in Christian ministry itself, except for Benjamin Rush and now R.G. Letourneau. And I want to focus on them because I want to focus on what you might call just a regular guy, because that is what the gospel is all about, right? It isn't just about... And we're talking about this a little bit in the message itself. It's not just about those who are paid to be good, as the old joke goes. And you guys are good for nothing. You know that one, right? You've heard it too many times, maybe. But it's about getting the gospel into the pews. And this one is kind of cool because Elaine Baxter's brothers knew R.G. Letourneau. So they attended his school, actually worked for the Letourneau Company, and then was with Letourneau on his private plane when he came into Rockford, Illinois to do a speaking gig years ago. So that's kind of cool. But let me start off with my favorite quote from the man. It says, "Two things I like most to do. One is to design machines, turn on the power, and see them work. The other is to help turn on the power of the gospel and see it work in the lives of people." That so encapsulates this man. I cannot possibly tell you how well that summarizes his life. His life theme was Matthew 6:33. This is the one he repeated to audiences thousands of times around the world. The verse is actually on his tombstone in Longview, Texas. "Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you." From all that I've read about Letourneau, he truly did seek the kingdom of God first by using his intellect, his money, and his passion to simultaneously build enormous machines. Still, to this day, that's the largest earth mover on the planet, but also to spread the gospel. And just a few lessons I've picked up and kind of summarized about the man. The first one is he constantly learned humility and trust through suffering. That's key. Learning humility, but doing it through suffering. Bob suffered, as you will see, many trials in his life, but while he was young, most of those trials were brought about by his own making. Now, Bob was raised in a Christian family, but his faith did not become his own for quite a while. He said this about himself: "I attended church regularly. I had no escape." Right? You ever feel that way as kids growing up? You attended church, but because you had to, because your parents bring. There's no escape from it. "And I heard a lot about God without learning anything." Heard a lot about God without learning anything. That can happen to us anytime. He was always bristling at his dad's authority. And that's a thing that can happen, you know, whether fathers or mothers bristling at their authority. One day, 13-year-old Bob got so mad, he ran away for several days. And he was desperate because they lived in Duluth at the time, and it was November. So he was really desperate to get out of the house. And by the time he returned, he had learned one of his first lessons, one of many, in humility. That, now quoting him, he says, "I saw my running away from home and rebellious stand in all its pettiness, and I was one repentant boy. I started to say so, but Dad stopped me. 'Don't say a word,' he said. 'I know what you've been going through. I've been going through it myself. So we're both wrong.' What a lesson that has been to me all my life." Listen to what he said. "Discovering my father's love changed my whole attitude. And chores that I had hated and fought against resentfully, I now did cheerfully because I wanted to serve him. It's like that, only more so when you discover the Lord. And you don't grow up and move away from your Father in heaven. He is with you always and everywhere. If you aren't serving him now, it's because you don't know him. But when you do know him, you'll love him. And when you love him, you'll serve him and find the greatest happiness in doing so that you'll ever know." Despite his mostly repaired relationship with his father, Bob still didn't like school. You know, he liked chores and family life, but he did not like school. Part of it was by the time he was in eighth grade, he was about to enter eighth grade, he was over 6 foot tall. He was kind of awkward in many ways. So he dropped out of school at age 13. That's going to be really important to remember as the story develops. During those years, he had a wide variety of jobs. He worked as an ironmonger, a lead burner, a bricklayer, carpenter, gold miner, stump puller, ditch digger, wood chopper, farmer, battery refurbisher, construction worker, tractor repairman, field leveler, with demoralizing intervals of unemployment in between those jobs. He experienced firsthand the San Francisco earthquake. He survived a broken neck, barely escaped death during the Spanish influenza pandemic, and faced financial ruin caused by an unreliable business partner. He quit formal school, but he was clearly living the life in the school of hard knocks. When he was 16, his family moved to Portland, and to this day, Portland isn't necessarily, without a doubt, not a godly place. It is a very secular, atheistic, New Age kind of a place, much more so back in those days. But the Lord brought the largest revival ever to the city, and this is pre-Billy Graham days, but before it was one of the largest revivals ever before the days of Billy Graham's revivals, and he was converted. But as I read about his conversion, listen to a parent's prayer that is just all over this thing. He records, he says, "No bolts of lightning hit me, no great flashes of awareness. I just prayed to the Lord to save me, and then I was aware of another presence." Isn't it that simple, right? You call out to the name of name of the Lord in repentance and humility, and he saves us. "No words were spoken. I received no messages. It was just that all my bitterness was drained away." So he's already experiencing the fruit of that. "I was filled with such a vast relief that I could not contain it all. I ran to my mother. 'I'm saved,' I cried. 'It happened. You don't have to worry about me anymore. I have felt the love of our Lord Jesus Christ.' There was a long silence followed by a deep sigh, a sigh of vast relief. Then, 'Robert, we knew it would happen. 2 years ago, when we discovered we couldn't guide you, we knew God would. We have left it in his hands ever since, praying every night that he would help you.'" What a great prayer for a parent. You know, Karen and I are the classic helicopter parents, you know, always wanting to be in every aspect of our kids' lives and paying for it at times. The kids are great. It's our reaction to what they're going through as a result. So that's a great, great prayer. And Bob would need that faith because his suffering was going to get a lot worse in his life. During World War I, maybe you've ever read about the Spanish flu epidemic, one of the worst epidemics in human history, killed almost 50 million people worldwide. Terrible tragedy, fascinating story how they actually discovered influenza bacteria, and it was able to discover cures for it because of that, but terrible. And he almost died from that. Sadly, though, their infant son, Caleb, did die from the disease. And we have recorded for us how he and his wife, Evelyn, processed that terrible grief together. He said, "I held Evelyn, but when I could not find words, it was to God that I addressed them. What's wrong? What have we done that we should be so punished? We've worked so hard." And what he's doing here is what we talked about at Equip this past week. He was lamenting to the Lord. He was pouring out his heart to the Lord. He's crying out for answers. "We've tried our best to be Christians. Oh, where have we gone wrong? That night, while we were still numb with sorrow, the answer came to me. 'My child,' the voice said, 'you've been working hard, but for the wrong things. You've been working for material things when you should have been working for spiritual things.' The words were few, but the meaning ran deep. All that long night, I reviewed my past and saw where I had been paying token tribute to God, going through the motions of acting like a Christian, but really serving myself and my conscience instead of serving Him. Instead of being a humble servant, I was taking pride in the way I was working to pay my material debts at the garage while doing scarcely a thing to pay my spiritual debt to God. From my lesson that night, I can now say that when a man realizes that spiritual things are worth more and certainly will last when material things are gone, he will work harder for spiritual things. I discovered then that God loves us so much that He wants us to love Him in return. He wants us to cooperate with His program. Matthew 6:33 says, 'But seek ye first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you.' That I had not been doing. I have been seeking first my own way of life, and I firmly believe God had to send those difficulties into our lives." Listen to that. "Had to send those difficulties into our lives to get us to look up into His face and call upon Him for His help and guidance." Severe grief visited them when their son was an infant, and then also 20 years later when their son, 20-year-old son Don, was killed tragically in a plane crash. Bob and his wife knew their share of grief and sorrow, but you can see, right, it began to shape him into the man that God wanted him to be. Second of all, his vast accomplishments made him more humble, not less. So these lessons of humility continued, and that was really important because vast accomplishments, vast wealth, is either going to ruin you or it's going to craft you into God's man or woman. Far too many of us, though, it would ruin us. This humility is going to be necessary because he is about to become rich and famous. He doesn't know it yet, but it's going to happen to him. And as you may have imagined, his business was big earth-moving equipment. But it didn't start out that way. Remember, when did he quit school? Seventh grade. He had a seventh grade education. He was poor, and at least formally so, very much uneducated, but he ended his life as a very wealthy man with 300 patents for machines and heavy equipment. He taught himself auto mechanics, diesel mechanics, then he taught himself drafting. Later on, he taught himself engineering. So he was formally uneducated, but he was without a doubt a multi-talented genius. And putting things into historical perspective, the machinery that he developed, etc. When Letourneau was born in 1888, excavation was still the old-fashioned way, just a shovel and thousands of workers. It was all done by hand. So he's born in 1888. Combustion engine was invented in 1872. So by the time Letourneau was in his 20s, there was such a thing as tractors, but really, for the most part, heavy equipment did not exist as we know it. So he single-handedly invented or improved the excavation business. And his biggest growth came in World War II. In his book, he recounts that thousands of heavy machines were used by the Army in World War II, were built by his company, including those that filled bomb craters in Hawaii after the attack on Pearl Harbor, created runways out of nothing in North Africa, cleared beaches in Normandy, island hopped with Marines in the Pacific. The Letourneau equipment enabled the Allied forces to build roads and airstrips rapidly, giving the Allied forces an advantage that ended up shortening the war. During the height of the war, from 1942 to 1945, his fertile mind pumped out 78 inventions, many of which were instrumental in helping to win the war. He revolutionized earth moving. During World War I, a bulldozer that took 1,000 men in World War I, a bulldozer now could do the work of 1,000 men in World War II. His equipment represented 70% of the heavy equipment that was used during World War II. In addition to all these things, and far too many accomplishments to possibly mention in this short message, but a few other things he did. He was the first to use rubber wheels on equipment. He designed and revolutionized factories and assembly lines because he was wanting to build equipment that did not exist, and there was no manufacturing that existed to produce the equipment that he wanted. So he created his own manufacturing process in order to do that. He revolutionized earth-moving manufacturing and engineering of heavy equipment. So how did he go from a poor, uneducated boy to a wealthy, genius inventor? Well, thankfully, he always gave credit to the Lord. He said this, "No one has ever measured the inventiveness that Christ awakens in a man's soul because it is beyond measurement. By accepting God as your partner, there is no limit on what can be achieved." I think that's such a great quote for anyone, but especially for a young person, you know, who's starting out, just realizing, yes, that's true. God has given me certain gifts, I have pursued certain skills and knowledge, etc., but nothing can substitute for the inventiveness of what Christ can awaken in your soul. But he didn't stop at earth-moving equipment. One of his greatest achievements came through working with this man in the center of that photo. I don't know if you recognize him at all. He was a very young George Herbert Walker Bush, became our 43rd president, but at this stage, he was the 32-year-old president of the Zapata Oil Company, and Letourneau designed and built the first mobile offshore oil drilling rig. But this technology was so new at the time that not even these billion-dollar oil companies wanted to risk any investment in this still untested technology. So what Letourneau did, he took on 100% of the risk for this massive project. And here, in his own words, are what the agreement that he did. He writes, "The Zapata Offshore Company would test the Scorpion," that was the name of the oil first one, Scorpion, "under actual operating conditions. If it worked as guaranteed, we were all in business. If it didn't stand up to my guarantee, and that's where I had to be pretty sure of myself, well, I'd be the small boy going back to school on a wrong guess." And sure enough, they built this massive thing. It floated out to sea, and then the legs go down and anchor it in the ocean floor. But that first test, something went wrong. I don't remember the details, but it didn't work. So he was such a genius, and this is recounted by, I think actually George Bush recounts this. He got down right there with chalk and designed the fix, and within a month had it fixed, and the thing was up and running. Then George Bush actually wrote about Letourneau in his autobiography. He said this, "What Letourneau proposed in regard to the oil rig," he said, "was a giant leap into the future. Not only was Letourneau's equipment different, but the man himself was unorthodox. Letourneau was gruff, eccentric, a kind of a George Patton of engineering. He was a man of action with a mystic touch, a dynamo, a creative genius. As a result of this first success, by 1970, the name Letourneau was affixed to more than 50% of the oil drilling rigs throughout the world's oceans." But again, his vast achievements, and they were still growing at this point, drew him closer to the Lord in true humility. What would it have done to most of us? It's hard to say, but it drew him to the Lord. But he said this, a confession. He said, I'll admit at one time, I feared my love of machines was becoming an obsession that was taking away from my love of God. I went to him for help and was reassured. I was just a mechanic, that he calls himself, he's becoming world-renowned, but he says, I'm just a mechanic striving to translate his laws in terms of machinery, and as long as I understood I was just his follower and didn't get to thinking I was operating under my own head of steam, I was on the right track. So just tremendous humility. Third principle, he did not make a distinction between the secular and the sacred. And this will become evident what I mean as I tell the story a little further, but remembering Matthew 6:33 was his life verse, and it's to this day inscribed on his gravestone in Texas. More importantly, the Lord inscribed it directly onto his heart. But as that process grew, and as he fell in love with Jesus all the more, he began to wonder, could he effectively serve the Lord as a businessman? Now, that's a good thing to think about, isn't it? And I think often when the Lord gets a hold of us, and I've seen this happen again and again. Like, for example, Jeff Gordon that came to help start Grace Church with me. So many of you don't even know that there were two full-time people helped start this church for the first 4 years. I was on partial missionary support. He was on 100% missionary support. So he made a tremendous sacrifice to move to Viroqua and do that. And I remember talking to him. We were in Chuck E. Cheese, some pizza place, having lunch as we would often do, and he was telling me that the Lord was starting to make his regular vocation feel futile. You know, the Lord just inserted this seed of futility in there, which was then he used to pry him loose. Not that there's anything wrong with what he's doing, working as a chemistry lab supervisor, but the Lord used that to pull him loose, to move him to Viroqua, and then moved him on to a position he's been now, Indiana Wesleyan University, that he thinks the Lord prepared him for his whole life. Absolutely, absolutely loves what he does there. So this is what Letourneau was wrestling with, and he's like, well, you know, to serve the Lord effectively, I should probably be, you know, a pastor. I should maybe be a missionary, you know, the Christian thing to do. So he sought some counsel, he talked to his pastor, and pastor said this. He said, you know, God needs businessmen as well as preachers and missionaries. And this is how what he said about those words. He said, those words have guided my life ever since. Many men have the same mistaken idea I had of what it means to serve the Lord. My idea was that if a man was going all out for God, he would have to be a preacher or an evangelist or a missionary or what we call full-time Christian worker. I didn't realize that a layman could serve the Lord as well as a preacher. So true that is. Before he talked with his pastor, he was making the mistake of separating the secular from the sacred. You see what I mean, right? The secular was that, you know, that's business, and that has nothing to do with God, and this is God's work over here, and if I'm really going to serve the Lord, I've got to leave the secular world and enter into the sacred world. And he learned what we need to constantly remind ourselves, that is a false dichotomy, that God weaves those two together in his sovereign work. For example, by now you're seen this diagram twice, and what it's representing is various groups of disciple-making activities. So you've got disciple-makers, you've got disciples around them, could be a family where the parents are the disciple-makers, hopefully are all a bunch of families, could be small groups, you know, whatever it is. All ways of having disciples and disciple-makers, and then, of course, all those little D's, Lord willing, will become DMs and disciple-makers themselves. And therefore, what I was illustrating the last month or so was that the only difference then between a regular disciple and a disciple maker and an elder is the amount of responsibility. The number of people that an elder is shepherding increases, as opposed to having two or three or five or ten. Now you've got 50, 100, several hundred. Then the only difference between an elder and a we usually call pastor is that's an elder who gets paid. That's just as simple as it is. It's just that simple. So what we need to understand is that, and what Letourneau was understanding is that after he caught this vision, he doubled his efforts to be the very best businessman he could possibly be and serving the Lord through that. One person said this about him. He said, what he did have was a Bible and confidence that God would guide him. Let me say it again. He had a Bible and confidence that God would guide him. Do you have that? Do you have a Bible? Do you have confidence that God will guide you? And this is especially true, again, I would say, of younger folks, but at any stage of life, right? Fundamentally, that's what we need. And I hope you are seeing life the same way, because it's far too easy to lack purpose in life in general, but I think especially in our vocations, I think that's especially true for men, that it's really a temptation to put all of our identity into our vocation. But I'm here to tell you and remind you that your vocation is not your identity, guys. That Jesus Christ in making disciples is your identity. Now, can you serve the Lord and make disciples in your vocation? Of course. Is there anything that's stopping you from making disciples in your vocation, even in the very small, just taking baby steps to do that? You are a disciple maker who happens to work in the profession that you do, whatever that is. I am a disciple maker who just happens to be a paid elder. Now, some of you, you're talking about, you know, businessmen who can serve the Lord. You don't have to be a pastor. You don't have to be a missionary. Some of you should. The Lord hopefully will lay that mantle upon you and lay that calling upon you, because some of you absolutely should and must do those things. So I don't want to diminish that for a moment. But for the rest of us, serve the Lord in your current vocation, whether it's now, whatever it is that you're doing for the rest of your life. We need to redeem our vocations for God's glory. We need to redeem our vocations for God's glory. And this decision by Letourneau changed his life. It created decades of remarkably fruitful ministry of many kinds. The first thing he did was to care for his own workers. He employed 3 full-time chaplains to minister to his people. They would have chapel service. They would be working. They would take a break and go to a chapel service right on the site of the factories and then head back to work. It reminds me of Caleb Michelson, right? If you don't know, Caleb Michelson works in Chicago, and he is a chaplain for Culver's. Can you imagine such a thing? But the owner of several Culver's restaurants had a vision, and it sounds like he took it out of Letourneau's playbook, that he would hire a chaplain to minister to his employees. But all of that was just the beginning of the ministry that Letourneau accomplished. He had a monthly publication called Now. It was begun by him, and at one time it reached 600,000 people worldwide. He traveled the world as witnessing as a Christian businessman. And he wrote this: for 25 years or more, I've been traveling this land of ours and a few foreign countries trying to teach and preach by word of mouth and example. What's he teaching and preaching? That a Christian businessman owes as much to God as a preacher does. Now, when you see Christian businessman, don't just think Christian businessman. Whatever your vocation, that a Christian in all of his vocations can be just as good as a preacher. He flew thousands of miles each week to maintain Christian speaking engagements around the United States and overseas. So Elaine's Baxter's 2 brothers, that's what they were doing. They were on a flight from Texas to Rockford, Illinois, so he could speak there. He served terms as president of the Christian Businessmen's Committee. He was president of Gideon's International for a while. He founded what eventually became Letourneau University, one of the premier Christian engineering schools in our country, while retaining its focus on teaching its graduates to be ambassadors for Christ throughout the world. Letourneau University also has the unique attribute of having expelled Franklin Graham, Billy Graham's son. I don't know the details, but he did something that got him kicked out of school. Then later, that same university granted him an honorary degree, which is all very interesting given the fact that Letourneau was friends with Billy Graham and would support his ministry, his worldwide crusades. Just absolutely fascinating life this man lived. With all of his wealth that the Lord gave him, he did not consider it his own, but used it to benefit those near and far. But he didn't start wealthy, did he? Started with a seventh grade education, absolutely almost dirt poor, and here was the trajectory of his early businesses. This is inflation adjusted. So by 27, he was $1.5 million in debt. So imagine carrying that weight today as a business owner. By 32, now he's got almost $1 million in profit. By 34, $6.5 million in profit. By 35, $37 million in profit. What are you going to do with that money? You're like, I'd like to try it, right? That's like what Tevye says. You know, only from Fiddle on the Roof. If only God would curse me with that wealth, you know, I'd like to give it a shot. I don't know that we would, right? Because the average person cannot handle that. It goes to their head. It ruins their soul and would be far too tempted by it. And this is what they were struggling with Bob and his wife. And he records now this, listen to this wonderful conversation the two of them had. He said, here we are, a hick from Duluth and a small towner from Stockton, and neither of us with a high school education. And sales zooming toward a figure that would go over $2 million mark for 1935, which was the $37 million mark. She was frightened, and she should have been. And now that she brought the subject to us up, so was I. You mean if we just give God, this is the conversation, if we just give God half the profits of the company, we won't feel anything personal about it, I asked. She nodded. Okay, we'll give half the company profits to the foundation, and then we'll give half of our own income to keep it personal. How does that sound? He says, I thought that sounded fine, but Evelyn wasn't through. That still leaves an awful lot. Since then, we've been able to increase the holdings of the foundation to 90% of our common stock and 90% of our income. Absolutely stunning. And who was the driving force? It was his wife. I love that part about the story. I mean, this just doesn't happen nowadays. You know, again, I said a few weeks ago, we think we're really generous when we give 10% of our income and keep the 90%, but they flipped tithing on its head, didn't they? Obviously, most of us can't give away 90% of our income, but why did he do that? So it would not take a hold of his soul, so it would not get embedded in his heart and ruin him forever. He said, I've got to give it away so it doesn't ruin me and so that the gospel will go forth. And that one conversation forever changed him and the trajectory of his life. So what he would do is he traveled the country and the world. He would speak about business and money wherever he went. And he developed, he became a treasure trove of amazing quotes. I'm going to just give you three of them here in a row. He says, I shovel out the money and God shovels it back, but God has a bigger shovel. And of course, I love that quote because he built shovels, didn't he? He built what is the largest shovel that still exists to this day. He wrote, I put my own confidence in God. If he wants you to make money to serve his purposes, you'll make it. If he doesn't want you to have money, he'll take it away. He'll take it no matter how much you might have. And then this last one, it's not how much of my money I give to God, but how much of God's money I keep for myself. It's pure stewardship. God owns everything. But then more, he wasn't done. In 1953, Letourneau began a development project in the country of Liberia, West Africa. He had somebody that came to him and challenged him at a conference, and he was really challenged by it. At first, he said, no, I can't do it. He's now quoting him. He says this, from a practical point of view, there was no way in the world I could take time out to go to Liberia. What was the solution? When I got down on my knees that night praying for guidance, there was no question about what my Lord wanted done. That wonderful and familiar voice, like something heard through earphones on a clear night high above the ocean, said this, of course you will go. This is the challenge of your life. This is what our partnership is all about. So he did go. And he outlined a four-point program, which really, even for its day, has some very sound missiological principles in it, and I want to show you what he outlined. He says, step one, by supplying the natives with machinery and training them in its use and maintenance, we would help them help themselves. That's always, of course, the key in helping anybody, not to just do it for them, but to equip them so they can do it themselves. And of course, he's a machinery guy, so he sees machinery as one of the cores to doing that. Step two, we would establish a model village to be called Tornada. Now, this is the one area that I could find to be critical of him.